international law. So in general, International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights recognized the possibility to exercise certain rights in the cases of national emergency.
Correct.
However, the covenant itself sets a very precise criteria when and how the state of national emergency can be exercised. And among those criteria is the explicit threat to the existence of the nation, as well as many other elements, including, for example, temporary character, for example, and announcement by at the level of law. And the last one, there is a certain scope of human rights which never can be violated, right? For example, the right to life, or the right to fair trial, or the prohibition of torture.
Correct.
In the situation of the United States, unfortunately, as I can see, it's not only situation of Iran. The United States chose a strategy to announce a state of national emergency in every case as a ground to introduce unilateral sanctions against other states or against individuals of other states.
So this is this is like an abuse of a principle which is acceptable principle, that a country can decide that there is a national emergency. This is within the rights of any sovereign nation to do this, or any government to make that distinction. But what it seems that the U.S. is doing is that it's declaring any country or any nation that might be going contrary to its desires as a threat to national life in the U.S. and using this as a tool to impose these sanctions, which then have this devastating effect on human rights. Have I understood what the Americans are doing correctly?
That's not about states only as a threat. So in reality, despite recognizing the fact that every state is entitled to announce the state of national emergency under the conditions and very strictly within the conditions
Correct.
Fixed in the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the United States is qualifying not only behavior of countries or specific events or even behavior of specific individuals as a threat to national emergency. However, the criteria of Article 4 of International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights are not observed. And it shall also be noted that when the U.S. is providing information from Universal Periodic Review to Human Rights Council, the U.S. has been repeatedly criticized for violation of Article 4. And I always refer to the violation of Article 4 and misuse of the state of national emergency in, I guess, nearly every communication I forwarded to the U.S.
Correct. So, in other words, what we see is that there is this term called lawfare. I'm sure you're familiar with it, where and the U.S. loves to do this. They use the law as a way of waging economic, political war with other countries. They're using some of the principles that exist in international law as it relates what you mentioned about a national emergency and having the right to declare that. And then using all these mechanisms to then impose these sanctions in order to get a political result, in order to force governments to comply with their desires. I want to now maybe move to the issue a little bit more specific about some of the people on the ground that are actually suffering in Iran from this, because you are very detailed in your report about the examples you mentioned. You talk about that basically, if I can say it in this simple way, that the people who are most affected by these unilateral sanctions, the ones that are suffering the most damage to their human rights, are the most vulnerable sectors of society: low-income people, women-led households, Afghan refugees, those who are basically at the bottom of the social ladder. So if you could please give us a little bit more detail about the devastating impact this has on the lowest social level in Iran.
Unfortunately, when it comes to the point of the use of comprehensive sanctions, or pretty comprehensive sanctions, those who are the most vulnerable, they are affected the most. So the most clear reason for that as soon as sanctions are imposed against the main sectors of economy, and especially when it comes to the banking sector, the level of poverty is usually rising. So every country faces economic difficulties, inflation, people lose jobs. And the number of people being at the lowest income level is increasing. Level of poverty is also increasing. So naturally, those who already had very little money, they have even less. So they can't afford even the basic standards, for example, like 3 normal meals or to buy basic medicine. For example, during the country visit to Iran, we have been reported about the cases when the poorest group of people were able to get the medicine at the very low cost with the subsidy of state, mm-hmm. and then they were trying to sell this medicine at the black market, much more expensive, in order to get money to feed their families. Correct. Because they have no other income.
They had to choose between medicine and food.
Indeed. Although they were able to get this medicine with the subsidies of state.
Correct.
When it comes to other categories, so all those who were economically not stable, they are affected. Moreover, it also comes to the possibility to get, for example, health assistance. During the country visit to Iran, I have heard a lot that many people who used to use private medical services when they were having a stable income, after losing their jobs, can't afford it any longer. So the number of people who were using public medical facilities is increasing because these people have to start use public facilities.
Correct.
And plus because of the growing number of Afghanian refugees. All people have equal access to these medical facilities, but the number of facilities as well as the number of doctors stay the same or is growing very slowly due to the absence of money to build up new facilities, to provide the equipment, and to provide necessary doctors. Coming to the next issue, we come to the problems with delivering necessary medicine and medical equipment, and that means that for those who can afford going abroad and buying a medicine for him or herself, it won't be such a huge problem as for those who will stay in the country and are only dependent on the subsidies provided by a state. Same comes to the issue of refugees. Iran is hosting an enormous number of Afghanian refugees. It's already higher than 5 million people.
Correct.
And these people need shelter, need food, need medical assistance, need education. To be able to accommodate these basic needs, there shall be money for social protection, to build new schools, to build new hospitals, and to provide a shelter and provide some sort of food or provide some monetary support for these people. And in the face of shrinking revenues, a government can't do it because there are no money. Money shall be put for other elements. And as a result, those who are sick and they can't get medicine in the country, they are affected the most. If they can get medicine in the country, and I received numerous reports about the domestic production of medicine, mm-hmm. may still be affected because the raw materials for production of this medicine are also imported.
That's
and
correct.
That's also an issue.
Yes, so we had this issue with the COVID vaccine, just for our audience to clarify. We were producing the COVID vaccine, but the problem was that some of the raw materials for it was not allowed to be delivered. So we lost a lot of people in Iran, even though we ourselves were producing the vaccine. Please continue, Professor.
So those who are sick, those who are poor, or those who are vulnerable because of other elements will be affected the most.
Professor, we've come to the end, but just to reemphasize the issue of the Afghan refugees, because this is really a tragic situation that we have. You mentioned that the U.S. is already blocking, freezing the assets of the Afghan Central Bank, billions of dollars. We have this new wave coming to Iran. We have all these issues. So we're not simply talking about a theoretical political discussion here. When these sanctions are imposed, you have real effects on the ground. The most vulnerable people, I don't know if there is any more vulnerable group of people in the world like the Afghans, as we've seen over the last decades. And now we have a situation where Iran, which traditionally was actually quite good at taking care of the refugees in its own territory without any or very little international support, is now being prevented from taking care of these millions of Afghans, and, you know, God knows what will happen. So, Professor, thank you very much for joining us on Insight. We had a lot more to discuss. Unfortunately, our time is over. Hopefully, when the report comes out in September, we'll have another opportunity to have a discussion at that time. Thank you so much, and thank you for joining us on Insight.
Thank you very much.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Professor Duhant? The most important thing we came to understand is that the unilateral U.S. sanctions against Iran are a violation of international law and have a devastating effect on the human rights of Iranians and vulnerable groups such as the millions of Afghan refugees living in Iran. The decades of illegal U.S. sanctions against Iran have not achieved their intended goal of regime change or even a change of policy by Iran, and thus can be rightly called a dismal and abject failure, particularly the maximum pressure sanctions imposed during the Trump era. In the context of domestic U.S. politics, sanctions are a risk-free and sadistic tool for lazy and dishonest politicians to show their Zionist campaign donors that they are punishing Iran for its resistance to U.S. hegemony in West Asia, particularly its resistance against the racist apartheid Zionist regime that aims to ethnically cleanse Palestinians from their homeland. In the judgment of the independent UN Special Rapporteur, these unilateral coercive measures imposed by the U.S. are a violation of international law, particularly those related to the banking, insurance, and shipping sectors, as they make humanitarian exchanges, which are supposedly exempt from sanctions on paper, impossible as a practical matter. For those in the West and other areas of the world who claim belief and adherence to international law as a basic value, it's very significant that the independent UN Special Rapporteur has judged these unilateral sanctions to be violations of international law and the human rights of Iranians and the millions of refugees living in Iran. And this has now been recorded as a fact in the annals of history and international law. This will have very little effect on U.S. elites who always view themselves above the law of nations and exempt from the same rules and standards that apply to all other humans on the planet. But it will have a significant impact on certain hypocritical European elites who very broadly open their mouths about international law and universal human rights, but who blindly follow whatever the U.S. orders them to do in violating international law and human rights. For the Iranians suffering under these sadistic sanctions, the UN report might not have much effect on their daily lives, but it does signify an intermediate moral victory for them in their decades-old resistance against American imperial crimes in West Asia. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is struggling to defuse a row arising from his insistence that he would remain in office until the 2030s. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Peter Walker and Andrew Sparrow. The piece is titled, "Johnson Says His Government is Exceptional as he tries to calm Tory MPs." Boris Johnson claimed on Sunday, 26th of June, that the record of his government was remarkable and quite exceptional, as he continued to brush aside internal Tory criticism of his leadership. However, in a series of interviews at the G7 summit in Germany, Prime Minister Boris Johnson sought to defuse the row triggered by his declaration that he wanted to remain in office until the 2030s, by saying he meant he was focused on his reform agenda. Coming after two huge by-election defeats, revived talk in the Conservative Party of Boris Johnson being forced out of office within weeks or months, the Prime Minister's comment about already planning a third term in office prompted claims he was delusional. As he was leaving the Commonwealth Summit in Rwanda on Saturday, 25th of June, Johnson was asked if he intended to serve a second full term in office upon winning a general election, taking him to 2028 or 2029. Boris Johnson replied, "At the moment, I'm thinking actively about the third term in office and, you know, what could happen then, but I will review that when I get to it." Asked what he meant by leaving after a third term, Boris Johnson said that would mean staying in office until the mid-2030s. Number 10 Downing Street initially suggested that Johnson might have been joking, but on Sunday morning, the Prime Minister said he was making a point about being focused on the long-term challenges facing the country. "What I'm saying is this, is a government that is getting on with delivering for the people of this country, and we've got a huge amount to do," he told reporters at the G7 summit in Germany. Johnson was even more bullish in a subsequent interview with ITV News. When it was put to him that the Conservatives lost the by-elections in Wakefield and in Tiverton and Honiton because voters had lost trust in him and that this should be a source of shame, Boris Johnson replied, "No, because I think if you actually look at what this government is doing, it's pretty remarkable and it's quite exceptional." Attributing the by-election defeats to the decision by the media to focus more on his personal conduct rather than on his policies, Boris Johnson went on, "If you want to look at examples of my leadership, then I would point to you to what we did to solve the Brexit problem, which was very, very tough. What we did was make sure we had the fastest vaccine rollout in Europe, and what we're doing now to help people through a tough time. Meanwhile, the Northern Ireland Secretary Brandon Lewis has told the BBC that it was a good thing that the Prime Minister was talking about a third term in office, because it meant he was thinking about long-term challenges. In his ITV interview, Boris Johnson also refused to deny a report in The Times, saying that he had discussed getting a Tory donor, Lord Brownlow, to fund the construction of a £150,000 treehouse at Chequers to be used by his son, Wilf. According to The Times, the plan was dropped after the police raised security concerns. Asked about the story, Boris Johnson said, "There is no such structure." Asked if he had discussed getting a treehouse built, he said, "All sorts of allegations had been made about his family in the past, and he never discussed them." MPs opposed to Boris Johnson are planning to use the forthcoming elections to the Conservative 1922 Committee to continue effort to unseat him. If a majority of anti-Johnson MPs are elected to the executive of the 1922 Committee, they could remove the current rule preventing another vote of no confidence before June of 2023. Over the weekend, Tory MPs urged cabinet ministers to be more robust in their opposition to Boris Johnson. Tim Loughton, a former minister, told Times Radio that he wanted to see more of them stand up to the Prime Minister. "What I want to see in the cabinet is more ministers prepared to say, 'Are you mad, Boris, if you're thinking about doing that?'" he said. Damien Green, who was de facto Deputy Prime Minister under Theresa May, went further, using an article in the Sunday Telegraph to urge them to mobilise against Boris Johnson. "It is not a secret that a significant proportion of the cabinet think they could do a better job of leading the country than the current incumbent," he wrote. "Now would be a good time to demonstrate those leadership qualities." But a report claiming that up to 6 Conservative backbenchers were considering defecting to the opposition was dismissed by a senior Labour source. "There are a lot of disgruntled people out there, and it is true that bits of conversation are going on," he said. "But that does not mean that people are ready to jump ship."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Now, the UN Human Rights Office agrees that the veteran Palestinian journalist was killed by Israeli fire last month. The probe finds that Abu Akleh and her colleague were targeted by seemingly well-aimed bullets as they covered a military raid in the occupied West Bank.
All the information we have gathered, including official documentation from the Israeli military and the Palestinian Attorney General, is consistent with the finding that the shots that killed Abu Akleh and injured her colleague came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians, as was initially claimed by the Israeli authorities.
So far, several media organizations have conducted their own investigations into the incident, and all have come to the same conclusion. Multiple witnesses also agreed with the probes, stating that Israeli forces shot the veteran Palestinian reporter. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the fingers at Israel from the outset. The UN has also confirmed that Abu Akleh was wearing a blue flak jacket marked with the word press when being shot by Israeli troops, exposing the gruesome nature of the daylight murder and suggesting that they were deliberately targeted.
As long as the United States and its allies continue to not only embrace this position, but to promote this position using every tactic at their disposal, including threats, the more that has been the case, the more the occupation is quite happy to resort to war crimes bordering on what one could also say are crimes against humanity, albeit in a very calculated move, drawn out over a period of decades, as is the case with ethnic cleansing, which if, of course, if it happened over a shorter period of time, would fit very nicely with the definition of a genocide.
The killing of yet another journalist is, however, in line with the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. Israeli brutality against Palestinians and journalists has been a topic of discussion for many years now. The regime has, however, never accepted blame for its wrongdoing, and in nearly all cases baselessly shifted the blame on Palestinians, and the case of Abu Akleh is no exception. Following the UN's report, the Israeli regime insisted that the fatal shooting of Abu Akleh was unintentional, pointing out at the same time that it had not received access to critical evidence that might determine whether she was killed by an Israeli soldier or a Palestinian gunman. Israel's military also says Palestinian authorities should hand over the bullet that killed Shireen. The demand has, however, been met by widespread criticism, with Palestinians saying the regime should hand over the gun which is believed to have killed the journalist, as Israel can't be trusted of conducting a fair investigation of itself. The murder of Abu Akleh, which sparked global outrage, only adds to Israel's long list of atrocities against Palestinians. But that fury has yet to translate into any concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. So far, several international organizations have provided evidence of Israel's brutality against Palestinians. UN resolutions have also been passed against Israel for its occupation and blockades of the coastal enclave. Yet, no one, including the UNSC, has used any of its tools to ensure resolutions related to ending the Israeli siege imposed on Gaza have been implemented.
The complete lack of accountability only encourages, as we have seen, more war crimes by the occupation. And the unfortunate that the position long taken by the number one sponsor of the occupation, the United States of America, is that Palestinians and Israelis should resolve their differences through negotiation, and in both instances should be prevented from invoking international law and the institutions which administer it in order to impose a solution in keeping with their respective legal obligations in the so-called rules-based international order. And that, of course, is really quite absurd.
Instead, many of the UNSC member states have doubled their support for Israel, despite its blockade and bombardment of Gaza and murdering dozens of innocent women and children. Some even increased their support for the regime and obliged neighboring countries to forge ties with it. And in absence of action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against the Palestinians, whether a journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear-armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war. The Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed. All of the NATO bases. It will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences. Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
Iran has released fresh details about the covert and planned operations of agents of Israeli spy agency in Iran. Officials say the three agents detained back in April were planning to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. Officials say the agents were arrested following a complicated intelligence operation that lasted 8 months. Judiciary officials say some members of the cell have been arrested in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, while other members and operatives have been detained outside the province by Iran's intelligence forces. Officials say the case is under preliminary investigation and that an indictment would be filed and sent to court soon. This is not the first time Iran busts Mossad-linked terrorists. In July last year, Iran's intelligence ministry arrested a network of agents with the Israeli Mossad spy agency at the western borders, confiscating a large cache of weapons and ammunition that they were planning to use to provoke riots and terror inside the country.
Well, of course there should be, and I don't think anyone is really going to seriously say it's unthinkable that Israel would try to assassinate Iranian figures, whether in science or politics. They've got a demonstrable propensity to do so, and they boast about it.
The arrests come amid open threats by Israeli officials against Iranian nuclear scientists and facilities. The regime is notorious for its sabotage activities and assassinations in Iran.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran and a very open hostility is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Israel has tried various ways to stop Iran's nuclear progress. They include acts of sabotage, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as threats to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Probably the most high-profile assassination was the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist who was brutally murdered by Mossad agents in 2020. Mossad was involved in an explosion that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in 2021. Israel was also the main regional force that pushed the United States to exert economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. The policy culminated in the so-called maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump, but none of those policies reached their stated goals. Iran's economy did not collapse, and its nuclear program has accelerated massively after the U.S. quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2018.
It's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something greater. It carries out assassinations, there's no question about that. It carries out bombings inside the country, carried out by covert agents. I think right now the United States government is not wishing to see an escalation into a full-blown war. And Israel does, in the final analysis, have to pay attention to what Washington thinks and says.
Just recently, a top U.S. think tank admitted to Israel's failure towards Iran. A report by Atlantic Council said that Israel's policy has failed to stop Iran. The article said the Tel Aviv regime needs to recalculate and adopt a strategy that corresponds to the current state of the Iranian nuclear program. Given the current state of affairs, the United States, which is Israel's staunch ally, needs to reconsider its unilateral support for Israel.
The meeting of leaders of the BRICS group of nations occurs amid major shifts in the geopolitical order. Talks have been held in a virtual format for the third consecutive year. The group owes its name to the initials of its five member states, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and emerged in 2009. This year, leaders focused on global economy and the changing dynamics of geopolitical and strategic alliances. Russia has already called on the group's members to integrate their payment systems and use their respective national currencies for intra-organizational trade. The call came amid the West's unprecedented anti-Russia sanctions over Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. The coercive economic measures have cut some Russian banks off from the SWIFT interbank messaging and financial system, and tensions with the West. China also sees the summit as a platform to promote its vision for how international relations should be conducted. Chinese President Xi Jinping made a four-point proposal on pursuing high-quality development of BRICS cooperation. Xi stressed that BRICS countries, as important emerging markets and major developing countries, need to act with a sense of responsibility to bring positive, stabilizing, and constructive strength to the world.
But if you look at the Western nations, in particular in the U.S., there's a strong anti-globalization trend. And what the U.S. is doing today is basically create a lot of, mischievous behavior policies to disrupt a global supply chain. That creates a lot of problems. So in that sense, I think they do the grouping have, the nations, they have a lot in common. And it's obviously everybody understands if they can unite with each other and have their voice heard, and they can better defend their interests and better build a more fairer and say a more just international order.
This year's agenda covered a range of topics, but particular emphasis was given to renewing multilateralism for global economic recovery, deepening coordination on climate action, and strengthening coordination on public health.
I think there are probably several issues, several reasons why it's resilient, why it's emerging stronger and stronger as a grouping. And firstly, I think it's, they have something in common. That is, they feel this international system, which was established mostly by Western countries, is not fair, is not just enough for developing countries, for example. We know that is Western countries' dominant international system. When the Western countries talk about, rules-based international order, often those rules are produced in Washington or in Brussels.
The economy has always been at the heart of the BRICS, but the Ukraine war loomed large over the summit. The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. Russia and China see the group as potential counterweight against Western-led hegemonic desires and imperialist intentions.
Obviously, now we are seeing the emerging of the multilateral world. You have Russia, which basically made it very public that the unilateral world has concluded, and the U.S. should accept that kind of reality, harsh reality for them. And with the rise of China, and we are basically seeing a center, another a new center. Before China's emerging power, you can see Washington would say the world center is in Washington, is in the U.S. And now you have a new center in Beijing.
BRICS nations have a combined population of 3.23 billion, and their combined GDP is more than $23 trillion. China proposed expanding the BRICS grouping during a meeting of the bloc's foreign ministers in May. Though the suggestion was welcomed by other member countries, there have been no official announcements of who the new members might be.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today we are going to touch upon the last parts of Imam Khomeini's testament where he addresses the Iranian nation. The Imam reminds the Iranian nation about the cost they have paid and the hardships they have endured to overcome the enemies and to achieve victory. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the Iranian nation, writes in his testament that the pains and sacrifices are the cost for reaching lofty goals. He writes, "Once more, in the end of this testament, I make bequest to the Iranian nation that, in this world, the magnitude of tolerating troubles, pains, sacrifices, and deprivations are compatible with the magnitude of the goal and its value and lofty degree. What you, the noble and Mujahid nation, have risen for, have been pursuing and sacrificing your life and property, is the loftiest, highest, and most precious goal and purpose which has been and will be presented since the advent of the world till the end. And that is the school of divinity, in the broad sense of it, and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions. The school of divinity and monotheism mentioned by Imam Khomeini has its roots in the belief that Allah is the only being who deserves to be worshipped." Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "The school of divinity in its broad sense and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions is the basis of creation and its ultimate point in the vast arena of being and the degrees and ranks of the unseen and the seen. And it has been manifested in the Muhammadan school in its full sense, degrees and dimensions, and all efforts of great prophets, greetings of God upon them, and the great friends of God, greetings of God upon them, have been made for that, and without that, it will not be possible to reach the absolute perfection and the infinite majesty and beauty. It is that which has made the inhabitants of the earth superior to the denizens of the ethereal heavens. And what the inhabitants of earth achieve in this journey will not be achieved by any creature in the whole creation, publicly or secretly." Imam Khomeini says that the Iranian nation is marching in the way of the divine prophets. He writes, "You, the Mujahid nation, are marching under the flag which is hoisted throughout the material and spiritual world. Know it or not, you are covering the way which is the only way of all great prophets, greetings of God upon them, and the sole way of absolute salvation. It is through this motive that all friends of God hog martyrdom and consider the Red Death sweeter than honey. And your youth in the battlefronts have drunk a sip of it and have become rejoiced. And it has been manifested in their mothers, sisters, fathers, and brothers. And we should truly say, we wish we were with you to achieve a great victory. May that soothing breeze and that zealous manifestation be sweet for them." Imam Khomeini explains that the spirit of devotion and cooperation ruling in the society is one of the manifestations of this sweet sense. He writes, "We should know that this manifestation can be clearly seen in hot farms, in breathtaking factories, in workshops, in centers of industry, invention and innovation, and among the majority of the nation in markets, streets, villages, and on all those who have overtaken these affairs to serve Islam, the Islamic Republic and progress and self-sufficiency of the country. And as long as this spirit of cooperation and devotion is there in the society, the dear country is, God willing, immune against every harm. And thank God, the seminaries and universities and dear youths of the centers of knowledge and education enjoy this divine unseen blessing." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continues in his testament, "My bequest to all is to advance, with Almighty God's remembrance, toward self-recognition, self-sufficiency, and independence with all their dimensions. And undoubtedly God's hand is with you. If you be at his service and continue the spirit of cooperation for the progress and sublimity of the Islamic country, with the wakefulness, vigilance, devotion, self-sacrifice, and the spirit of resistance and resolve that I see in the dear nation in the way of truth, I hope that, through Almighty God's favor, these humane concepts will be transmitted to the posterior of the nation and every generation will enhance it." Imam Khomeini ends his testament with these words, "With a calm and confident heart, happy spirit, and an inward hopeful of God's favor, I take leave from the sisters and brothers and travel to the eternal abode while I am in urgent need of your good prayers. And I plead with God, the compassionate and the merciful, to accept my apology for coming short of service. And I hope that the nation will accept my apology for shortcomings and faults. They should go forward with power and resolve, knowing that with the departure of a servant, there will be no crack in the iron dam of the nation, as there are more superior servants at the service. And Allah is the guardian of this nation and the oppressed of the world."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. During the sacred defense era, he did so in one way and during the coup launched by the Americans at the air base in Hamadan, he did it in another way. It would not be bad for me to recount this memory. After I was informed of a coup by conscientious, pious and young pilots in the Air Force, I notified different organizations and they got ready. The late Mr. Hashemi and I went to Imam because we were worried that Imam might be in danger. We suggested that he leaves his house in Jamaran. He did not accept it, saying that he would not leave. "I will stay here. But you should go and protect such and such a place." He mentioned a certain place, which I do not want to mention, and asked us to go and protect it. He would show the arena fighting like this. The same is true of this action at that time, at the time of the sacred defense era. This way was confronting Saddam and his behavior during accepting the resolution.
دنیای اسلام
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you look at Imam's manifesto for accepting the resolution, you notice that Imam had determined what the people had to do after accepting the resolution. He had explained to the people what the arena of fighting would be after his demise. Imam's testament, statements, and important manifestos in the last year of Imam's life, may God bestow paradise on him, were all efforts to show the arena of fighting to the people after his own time. Well, leading the revolution means this. Leading the revolution is a really significant and meaningful term regarding our magnanimous Imam. In studying the personality of that great leader, we can examine his personal traits and his school of thought. Of course, these require long and detailed discussions. I'll try to briefly raise certain points in this regard. As for his personal traits, a magnanimous Imam was an exemplary personality in the true sense of the word. He was real exemplary. His personal characteristics were such that few personalities could have all together.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding.